Well, let's meet Dr. Elizabeth Loggison. She's just completed a 3-day workshop at the University of Sydney about how to help young adults with autism make friendships, keep socialising, and also then have a better quality of life throughout their life. She's come to do that from the US and she's with us, I'm glad to say. Welcome. Wonderful to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, Cassie. Appreciate it.
Now, you have an incredibly impressive CV. So you work in neuroscience, in psychiatry, in biobehavioral issues. Mm-hmm. You're a psychologist. So when you approach the complexities of autism, mm-hmm. which one of those are you primarily approaching it with?
Yeah. Well, I'm mostly interested in the social aspect of autism, which really, you know, autism is a spectrum disorder. And one of the hallmark features of those with autism is difficulty in social interactions and social communication. And so that's what my area of specialty is to help individuals on the spectrum learn how to make and keep friends, how to handle conflict and rejection, things like teasing and bullying, and also for adults, how to develop close, meaningful romantic relationships.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So autism has come a long way in our understanding generally in the last few decades. Mm-hmm. We now know that it is a spectrum. There are many, many different experiences of it, as many as the people who have it, who
That's
live with
right.
it. What's going on inside a brain that has autism that makes socialization in particular difficult?
Well, one of the things that we know about individuals in the spectrum is that they're really struggling with understanding the perspectives of others. And we technically refer to that as social cognition, but it's essentially just putting yourself in someone else's shoes and being able to anticipate how they're going to think or feel or react in response to something we do or say. And that makes their social interactions very difficult. And then on top of that, they also have difficulty interpreting social cues. So knowing if someone's interested in talking to them, for example, or how they affect another person that's difficult for them to pick up on. So the social cues that we often just pick up on naturally don't come naturally, unfortunately, to people on the spectrum.
So these are things that can be learned and can be taught.
Absolutely. Though there's a whole science behind making and keeping friends and developing relationships. And we've essentially in our research broken down all of the rules and steps that many of us follow naturally into concrete parts that people with autism can understand.
Mm-hmm. You must have spoken to so many people who are classified as being on the autism spectrum. I know they are all experiencing life differently, but can you give us an idea what you've learned about inside the autistic brain? What you're looking through eyes that have this condition, what's the world like?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, the world is often quite lonely for people on the autism spectrum, although you wouldn't necessarily know that looking from the outside. You know, in fact, back in the 80s and the 90s, before we knew much about autism, there was a whole myth about people with autism that they were asocial, that they weren't interested in socializing, that they were perfectly happy just sitting on the computer or playing video games and not interacting with other people. But that actually turns out to not be true. And the vast majority of people on the autism spectrum really want to have friends and meaningful relationships with other people, but they don't know how to. And as a result, they often experience tremendous loneliness.
And what else is it that might give us a glimpse into their space?
Yeah. Well, one of the issues for many people on the spectrum is they have difficulty labeling and identifying emotions in themselves and others. And as a result, they're not always that great at talking about feelings. And because they aren't so great at talking about feelings or labeling emotions, people often mistakenly believe that they don't have feelings. And so they go through this very lonely existence, and they do that often in silence because they're often not able to communicate the feelings that they're experiencing. And the sad result of that is that there's a really high incidence of things like anxiety and depression in people with autism, and that tends to worsen as they enter adulthood. And so that's why we've developed the program that we have to really address those social issues, to try to overcome the barriers that they often experience in social situations so that they can develop close, meaningful relationships with other people.
So how do you go about that, changing what might on the outside look like a lack of empathy into maybe a more communicative individual?
Well, we have to start by decoding the social world. The social world is a mystery for people on the autism spectrum. And so we have to take what rules and steps we all naturally follow and break those down into concrete parts for people on the spectrum. So to give you a quick example, you know, we have to figure out how do we interact with people? How do we meet new people? Well, adults will often give kids advice about what to do in these situations. Like, imagine you have a kid, any kid, not even a kid with autism, who's maybe going to some party or social gathering. They don't know anybody. What advice do you think that most adults will give to that kid to meet new people?
Let me think. Go up and say hello, smile.
That's right. They're told to go up and say hi, maybe smile. They're often told to go up and introduce themselves either. Uh-huh. Now, Cassie, let's just think about this for a second. Could you imagine sending this poor kid to some party where they don't know anyone and they go up to a group of people, they barge into the conversation and they say, "Hi, my name is Liz," or "Hi, my name is Cassie." How do you imagine that people are going to react to that kid?
Yeah, who's that?
Yeah, it's a strange thing to do. So what we've discovered in our research is that very well-intentioned adults often give really bad advice in social situations. And I think that's because social skills come so automatic to so many of us that we don't even think about what we're doing. And so we can inadvertently give bad advice in these situations. So the research that we do at UCLA is really to try to decode what people that are socially successful are naturally doing. And then we want to teach people with autism or others who are struggling socially how to do those things.
Others who are socially struggling, I was just about to say, this could have a lot of practical implications, Liz.
Absolutely. In fact, even though our program, PEERS, was developed for people on the autism spectrum, it's really used with anyone who's struggling socially and wants to learn how to make and keep friends. And again, the way we teach these skills is by breaking them down into concrete rules and steps. So the example, for example, that I just gave about meeting new people is really quite simple if you look at the research. So imagine you are at some kind of social event. Maybe it's a work party, maybe it's some kind of social gathering, and you want to, you know, talk to people, mix and mingle. How would you do that? Well, the first thing,
with a drink in my hand,
with a little liquid courage, perhaps. But even with that liquid courage, you're probably going to begin by doing something with your eyes and your ears. What do you think you're going to be doing?
Well, making eye contact, and maybe even nodding and smiling, but listening as
well. But listening. And what do you think you're listening for?
A gap in the conversation.
Yeah, a little pause in the conversation. But also in the meantime, you're listening for the topic to figure out what they're talking about. Now, you don't want to look like the creepy stalker over in the corner. So you're probably also using some kind of prop, like a phone or, you know, some maybe reading material if it's a work event. But you want to look distracted because, you know, the reality is you're eavesdropping, but you don't want to look like you're eavesdropping. So people will use a prop, but you're identifying the topic. You're figuring out if you know something about the topic. Now, you're right. You're also going to wait for a little pause, but you also might even have to move a little bit closer to the group. And then when there's a little pause, you're going to make a comment, or you're going to ask a question, or maybe give a compliment. You're going to say something that's on topic. And that's what people naturally do to meet new people, to join conversations. It's not go up and say hi or go up and introduce yourself. But again, because we use those skills and they come to us so naturally, for many of us, we don't even think about what we're doing. But by looking at these behaviors through research, we can decode the social world for people with autism and people that struggle with social situations.
Liz, I don't know how you've done it, but you seem to have stumbled on one of my most most anxiety-inducing situations. But you've also decoded it so that we can see just how complex that exchange actually is, that we might take for granted, and how much we have learned, that we have ingrained through social training, social conditioning that others may not have. We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Logerson. She's here from the US. She's the director of a program called PEERS at the University of California in Los Angeles. It's all about training, really, people who have autism to be able to interact in social situations and maintain relationships, which, as she's telling us, is crucially important so they can avoid depression and loneliness and maybe even increased anxiety around some of this stuff. So take us through what you do in the program. Now, you have a focus on young adults, adolescents with autism. Is that too late to be introducing this training? Does it need to be done, you know, ASAP?
You know, great question. We do know that early intervention is very, very important. And we do have social skills interventions for younger children with autism and other social impairments. We have a program called PEERS for Preschoolers. And it's what you imagine. It's a social skills intervention for younger kids, usually before the age of 6, that teaches them also about how to make and keep friends. But I'm sure you could also imagine that the social skills that you need as a preschooler are quite different than the social skills that you need in primary school or secondary school or on into adulthood. And so what we've discovered is that there's different phases of development where the social demands change, and we need to keep up with that. So even though we may intervene early with even preschoolers, the social skills that they learn at that age will be different than the social skills that they'll need later in life.
How many people actually can benefit from this kind of training? I guess I'm asking you a broader question about autism, and that is, how many people who have it just beyond being able to learn these skills and to break through the barrier between them and the rest of the world to interact? Is it a large percent?
Well, we've trained tens of thousands of people through the PEERS method over the years. This program originally developed at UCLA in 2004, but since that time, it's turned into an international program, and the program's now used in over 35 countries, including Australia, and it's also been translated into over a dozen languages. So it does have the capacity to reach many, many people. And that's why I'm so excited to be here in Sydney now, just having completed a 3-day training.
So you were training trainers how to implement it.
That's right. So for the past 3 days, we've been at the University of Sydney training mental health professionals and educators on all of the methods that we use in the PEERS program. And the idea is that now these professionals will go back to their various agencies and organizations across Australia and implement this program for families in their area.
Yeah, interesting, because one of the things that's emerged out of the implementation of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, which is only recently really begun to lift off in Australia in earnest, what has been reported recently is that there have been so many people with autism applying to be part of the scheme that they're now looking at changing the settings of who qualifies for support in autism services and all the attendant expenses that come with it. Is it an expensive condition to treat? Are programs like yours expensive?
Well, I suppose it depends on who you ask, but what's unique about this program from others is that PEERS is time limited. It's only 16 weeks in length. The duration of the groups are once a week for 90 minutes. So in the grand scheme of autism treatment services, it's probably quite inexpensive compared to others. And many other social skills groups will meet for years at a time for individuals on the spectrum, often with very little gain in social skills. And our program is really one of the only evidence-based or research-supported programs, which makes it rather unique. But it's also unique in that it's time-limited. And the reason that we can have the length of time be so limited is because we include social coaches in all of our treatment programs. So that means that we either have parents or other caregivers concurrently going through the program with they're adolescent or adult. And the idea behind having these social coaches or caregivers involved in treatment is that when you include parents, for example, in a program like this, the program never ends.
Hmm.
And the idea is that these adolescents and adults are going to need additional support across their lifespan. But if we include people who care for them in the treatment, teach them to be social coaches, much in the way that we might be as mental health professionals or educators, then you have a much more viable, more sustainable and durable program.
And maybe it is even also cost saving down the track. I know that Headspace, which is one of the youth mental health service networks around the country, they say that 45% of people with autism come to them reporting severe levels of depression and anxiety. So there are costs when this is not treated in an expedient way, I guess I'm saying. Just finally, before we let you go, there will be people listening with very, very young children wondering if this might be something that relates to them and their family. How early, in your experience, can you detect an autism condition in a child? Is it as early as the very first month?
That's debatable. I think that most researchers in this field would argue that we're getting better at screening and even diagnosing earlier in childhood, and in some cases as early as 18 months. But we normally at that time are identifying high-risk infants and toddlers and not necessarily giving a full diagnosis perhaps until around the age of 3. But I do believe that with early intervention, many of these children and toddlers can actually benefit from the services that are provided for high-risk youth.
Mm-hmm.
So as early as 18 months, we have found in research that there are signs and symptoms of autism.
And maybe with the more, I think you said, high-functioning mm-hmm. individuals, it may be later on in life that
That's
it
right.
becomes clear that it's part of this spectrum.
That's yeah. correct, yeah.
We're learning more about it all the time. Dr. Elizabeth Logerson, thank you so much for talking with us and thank you for bringing this interesting information to the country.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Elizabeth Logerson is the director of the UCLA Peers Clinic, which is an outpatient hospital-based program which provides parent-assisted social skills training for preschoolers, adolescents, young adults with autism spectrum disorders and other social impairments. She's been giving a workshop on this, a 3-day workshop. It's in Sydney over the last few days. And she's also a clinical psychologist at UCLA.